This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana Signature Support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. It is always a treat to catch up with Smiley Gray Anders Jr. He reaps the harvest of Louisiana humor, sets it on the table for his readers 6 days a week, and the native of Natchez, Mississippi, received his BA and MA degrees in journalism from LSU, member of the Manship School Mass Communication Hall of Fame. He and his wife, Lady Catherine, live in a 1922 home in Spanish Town. And that means next year their home on University Walk will be 100 years old. And Smiley Gray Anders Jr. tomorrow will turn 84. 84 for Smiley Anders. Happy birthday, Smiley.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate that very much.
Well, it is always a pleasure. This is a tradition that we like to keep going. I noted that you've written your column for 42 years. And you're 84, and that means half your life has been spent writing this column.
That's right, and I'm going to get it right sooner or later. I'm just going to keep trying. You
know. Well, you're not going to give up that column, I hope. And Smiley, of course, is a survivor of COVID, and as you can hear, still has some residual breathing issues, but every day you churn it out like nobody else, and you're one of the few people in the country still doing this sort of thing, maybe the only person.
Yeah, there are very few like daily columns out there. I don't really know of any of them right now. There was, of course, some on the West Coast, I guess, Herb Cain, with the San Francisco Chronicle, was the most famous daily items column. This, of course, he's long gone, but it's kind of an unusual column, I guess. So,
for an iconoclastic person, one Smiley Gray Anders Jr., who was born in Natchez, grew up in Baton Rouge, went to Estruma and was a classmate and sat next to one Billy Ab Cannon, who, of course, became a Heisman Trophy winner and a dentist and a man about town, one of the most famous Louisiana people of all. And they both were born in the great state of Mississippi. But, Smiley, when you think back on those years, as we get older, I'm a little behind you, but, you know, 20 years is not much when you're our age. But it's a case in which yesterday seems like, in your case, 70 years ago, when you were next in class to one Billy Cannon.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it a while ago. And as I said before, Cannon was a real smart kid, and I used to copy off of him. I sat behind him in American history, and if I was doubtful about something, I'd look over his shoulder, and which was kind of hard. He had big shoulders, of course, and I look over his shoulder and see if he had the right answer. He was almost always correct.
He was a smart man, and of course, a brilliant athlete, one of the great athletes of his time. As someone said, if he had gained 20 pounds, he would have been the world's strongest man, and if he had lost 20 pounds, he would have been the world's fastest man. Still holds a record for the 100 yards at LSU, 9.4 seconds, and he weighed about 220 when he ran it. He was an amazing physical specimen, as we know, ran into trouble. Smiley has had a pristine reputation through the years, and is a guy who enjoys life. And when I say pristine, that didn't stop him from going to night spots. And invariably, when he's on, people want to think back to old Baton Rouge. And here's a question from a listener, one out of nowhere. I think somebody must know us. Hal in Monroe asks, do you remember the Tonga Isles, Smiley?
It was at the Rio of Balmarche, wasn't it?
I think it was.
Am I correct on that?
Yeah.
It was a tiki bar. They had served drinks and pineapples and stuff like that. We had a few of those around, you know, Polynesian flavored bars.
I have noted that on November 22, 1963, when you were working at the Farm Bureau, you left their office at 9521 Airline, and you were devastated at the loss of the 35th American president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, at the age of 46, I might add. And you went to the 19th Street location called Chris's Bar, where they served beer and fish bowls. I bet you had a few fish bowls that afternoon.
I, I certainly did. We sat down. They had an old black and white TV up over the bar, and it was a Chris was kind of a dive, but they had some pool tables and served red beans and rice once a week, and you know that kind of stuff. And we sat there, and some of my buddies drifted in who had the same idea that I did, that they didn't want to go back to work. They didn't concentrate on what they were doing. So we sat there and drank beer and watched that old black and white TV, and as those horrible events unfolded, and we couldn't believe it. It looked like the country was heading downhill, you know.
58 years ago. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, I was
hard to believe.
Yeah. I was five at the time, and I remember it, but it changed the course of American history. And now, as time goes on, most Americans were not alive then, but most Americans, fortunately, do know the importance of that date. Now, the date that we're reflecting on right now is November 20th, which means it's Smiley Anders' birthday, born in 1937. He's 84. The President of the United States, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., will be 79 tomorrow. I see he's getting his annual physical.
Yeah.
I suspect that he will show a weight a bit less than his predecessor.
Yeah, I would think so. Probably the IQ would be a little higher too, but I don't guess we ought to get into that. So that would be political, I suppose.
It would be. But this is a political show, so let it all go. Let it go. Get it off your chest, Smiley. Get it off your chest.
It's okay. It's okay then.
Well, he will be 79 years old, oldest president in U.S. history. And then on Sunday, a notable day, the man from Centerville, Mississippi, also a Mississippian who came to Louisiana and made a splash, John Neely Kennedy, the junior senator from Louisiana, will turn 70 years old. And yesterday, Smiley, Senator Kennedy made news on Capitol Hill when he was questioning a nominee from President Biden, this lady whose last name is Omarova, Saleh Omarova, I think is the way she pronounces her name, his pick to lead, Biden's pick to lead the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, was testifying before a committee of which John Neely Kennedy is a member. And Senator Kennedy, I'm reading from the New York Times, says to Ms. Omarova, "I don't know whether to call you professor or comrade," prompting someone in the room to whisper, "Oh, my goodness." Well, here's how it actually sounded at the moment.
In 2019, you joined a Facebook group, a Marxist Facebook group, to discuss socialist and anti-capitalist views. Now, that's what I see from your record. And you have the right to believe every one of these things. You do. This is America. But I don't mean any disrespect. I don't know whether to call you professor or comrade.
Oh, my goodness. Senator, I'm not a communist. I do not subscribe to that ideology. I could not choose where I was born. I do not remember joining any Facebook group that subscribes to that ideology. I would never knowingly join any such group. There is no record of me ever actually participating in any Marxist or communist discussions of any kind. My family suffered under the communist regime. I grew up without knowing half of my family. My grandmother herself escaped death twice under the Stalin regime. This is what's seared in my mind.
All right. Now, some are saying that what Senator Kennedy smacks of McCarthyism. Is that a stretch, or should the senator be scolded for his remarks?
He should be kicked out of the Senate, I think, for that's as reprehensible as you can get. These are people who escaped communism, and to be accused of being communist, here is a woman who doesn't look like us or sound like us, and he figured she was fair game for that kind of game. And it's just reprehensible. He's not strong enough. I mean, that's utterly, utterly shameful. He should be very much ashamed of that, and he has no place in the Senate. And I'm ashamed that he represents our state. I don't know. I don't feel very strongly about it, but that's just what I think.
I think your views are shared by many. But on the other hand, I think some people are saying, go Senator Kennedy, and he's learned how to play to his base, and he's running for re-election. He's a very skilled politico, and he may even have a poll saying that this is good politics. But sometimes, Smiley, we have to put politics aside and be humans, and this lady was publicly humiliated, and there are other, as the New York Times points out, she's had some positions that are worthy of scrutiny, but to criticize her because of her ethnicity, I'm with you. But happy 84th birthday to you, Smiley Anders.
Well, thank you so much.
And God bless you. You keep going. Nice. You inspire me every day. So keep going, Smiley Anders. Love you. Let's keep talking.
And thank you here.
We'll be back. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Alondra Villarreal is producing. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting, and your number is 877-217-5757. We're joined for a segment by Jerry Seppos, the former dean of the Manship School, longtime journalist of renown, headed newspapers across the country, and he is hot and bothered about what the Faculty Senate at LSU did this week, and there is a statement that has emanated from several people affiliated with the Manship School. It reads, "We, the journalism faculty of LSU's Manship School of Mass Communication, condemn the Faculty Senate's expulsion of a student reporter and members of the public from a crucial Senate meeting Monday. The reporter from the Reveille was the only journalist present. The Senate failed its ethical obligation to set a good example for students when it endorsed doing the public's business secretly. It also undoubtedly failed a legal obligation. The Louisiana Open Meetings Law requires that public business be performed in an open and public manner." And those who signed this include not only Jerry Seppos, but the dean before him, Jack Maxwell Hamilton, who's also, like Jerry, still teaching there, Lynn Apkar, Cindy Carter, Roxanne Dill, Chris Drew, Bob Mann, Ruth Moon, and others. Now, Jerry Seppos, it is amazing that the Faculty Senate would do this, but what was the precipitating moment for this to happen?
Well, some people are trying to complicate it, but the Faculty Senate president just capriciously closed the meeting, apparently, and I can't get into her head, but apparently she didn't want the public to hear discussion of a vote of no confidence in Faculty Senate leadership that was up for consideration. But this isn't a case of national security. This is a public body, the LSU Faculty Senate, debating a resolution of no confidence. And the fallback position always should be that meetings of public bodies are open to the public. I mean, it's just common sense. Why would you prevent the people who are paying for LSU to not attend the meeting? It makes no sense.
And we do invite anyone from the Faculty Senate who wishes to comment a place at the table on this program, just as Dean Seppos is receiving today. But university, and we've gone down this road on other issues, most universities pride themselves on open thought and expression. And here we have the Faculty Senate, which, by the way, censured King Alexander for more than 5 years for his handling of the firing of a faculty member, and publicly excoriated him on its website, and they go into a secret meeting. It is a disconnect, it would seem.
Yeah, it certainly would. And as I said, this is not something that should be kept from the public, and it's not something so top secret that we can't trust the public. That's what it really gets to me, that we're saying, oh, we're above the public. Yeah, they're paying our salaries, by the way, but we're above them. We can't trust them with a discussion of the leadership of the Faculty Senate. And then I have to say, as somebody who's been very involved in student media since I was editor of the student newspaper of the University of Maryland many years ago, an added insult is that the only reporter there is a student reporter from the Reveille, which is a much honored student newspaper, and that she would be kicked out too. Mm-hmm. She's the eyes and ears of the public, and she's kicked out. It makes no sense at all.
The missive from the faculty reads also, the Senate's action demonstrated remarkable contempt for the much-honored 134-year-old Reveille, whose alumni work for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Advocate, Politico, CBS, NBC. Despite the Senate's blatant move to avoid transparency, we will continue to teach future journalists that they, as representatives of the public, deserve access when state-funded institutions make important decisions. And another listener notes that the aforementioned King Alexander, the former president of the university, was on this show a few months ago and noted that he was ordered to fire the athletic director, Joe Oliva, at a secret meeting, which would have been illegal, by several board members and those present. According to King Alexander, he named the names, but many are still on the board. And unfortunately, in some cases, this is done as a matter of practice. It's basically thumbing their noses at what is public law.
That's correct. And the natural instinct should be to keep public meetings public. I mean, that's the whole idea. Whereas it seems to me that in this case and several others like the one you mentioned, the fallback position is to close the meeting, not to keep it open. It's upside down is what it is.
All right. Tracy at the Capitol asks a good question. Was there a move by the faculty senate to go into, quote, executive session?
There was a, as I said, a capricious move. The president of the faculty senate said something to the effect of, is anybody opposed to an executive session? And at that point decided that not enough people were opposed, and she adjourned to an executive session. State law spells out very specifically and very simply the steps you need to take to do that, and she did not take them at all.
Henry at the Country Club. Henry, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Oh, good morning, Dean, and good morning, Mr. Jim. Dean, I bought your book on covering politics, and it's a great book. I encourage everybody else to buy it, too. Look here.
Thank you.
This I'm sorry?
He said thank you.
I said thank you.
Oh, okay. This faculty senate president, I don't know who the lady is, never heard of her before. But, Mr. Jim, I think it's fair to say, would our friend Kevin Cope allow such a thing as this to happen? We all know the answer to that. Maybe it's time we clean house and get us a new faculty senate president.
Well, that may very well be the case. This was what this was about, wasn't it? Wasn't it a review of her performance that was under discussion?
Actually, the entire leadership of the Senate, including her. Yeah. Correct.
And faculty members by nature tend to be contrarians. That's what faculty members are, and God bless them. We need contrarians in our world. But it is amazing, and I've seen this happen before. Like, for example, here I am saying transparency, but I will acknowledge that if I were chair of a meeting and the meeting was about my competence, I wouldn't feel real comfortable about having this in public view, but nonetheless, I would allow it to move forward. It would have to go forward. Either that or resign. That's basically the choice.
Right. It goes with the territory that certain things are public knowledge. I wasn't real happy that I, when I was dean, was occasionally in the spotlight. But hey, I was dean, and the taxpayers of Louisiana paid me to be dean. So I didn't have any choice.
And that brings us to another good question from Holly in the Garden District. Do the rules apply differently, say, at LSU than they do at Tulane or Loyola?
Oh yes. Tulane and Loyola are not public institutions, so the open meetings law would not apply to them.
It's still a good idea, though.
Oh, absolutely. And if I were either of them, I would tout the fact that if I had a meeting that was public, I would tout the fact that it doesn't need to be, but we're doing it because it's the right thing to do. But they are not required to do it under state law.
Well, this is a who's who of the faculty that signed off on this, and I know these are very accomplished people, including Dean Seppas. sometimes the people on this list don't agree with each other, but on this one, they signed off wholeheartedly.
Yeah, it was remarkably easy to gather the signatures, and that is the entire journalism faculty part of the Manship School. I thought it was interesting that there was no disagreement whatsoever.
Well, we will see what happens. What do you think the next move is?
Don't know. I'll be interested to see if there's any legal action. That wouldn't be our decision at all. And what I would hope the next move is, but I have no confidence that it will be, is that the Faculty Senate would reconsider. That would be ideal, and open the meeting back up, and then, you know, discuss whether the vote of no confidence is a good idea, and vote for it openly the way it should be done.
Thank you, Dean Sepos. Always good to talk with you, sir. We'll keep in touch, and we'll return with more Talk Louisiana. Your number 877-217-5757. Back after this quick timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few moments. We'll hear from Chris Rosada, the Capitol correspondent for WAFB Channel 9, one of the top television stations in North America. But we're joined for a few moments by Jennifer Cook, native Dallasite, worked at Mary Kay Inc. while earning a bachelor's degree in English and then worked full-time after graduation. Jennifer retired from Mary Kay in 2017 after a 45-year association with the company. She worked directly with Mary Kay Ash for 25 of those years. The book is Pass It On, What I Learned from Mary Kay Ash. And, of course, this is an entity that is known nationwide, if not worldwide, and revered. And appropriately, the book is in pink. And good morning to you, Jennifer.
Good morning. Thank you for having me this morning.
Do you drive one of those pink Cadillacs?
Oh, the pink Cadillacs are reserved for our top saleswomen, and let me tell you, they earn those pink Cadillacs.
So is that a no?
That is a no. I worked in the office and in the corporate headquarters, well, so I never sold the product.
But you could still drive one.
I could, but they're reserved for them.
Well, you have this long association with Mary Kay Ash, and like some big companies, sometimes information is a bit insular and people are a little reluctant to tell all. What prompted you to write the book?
Well, after I retired from Mary Kay, I became involved in a Christian mentoring group called Forward. And as a mentor, I discovered that I was using so many of the lessons that Mary Kay had taught me. And I realized these lessons are timeless. This woman was a great leader, and I need to share what I learned from her with others. And she always told people that to pass on anything that they had received from her. And I just felt that this was a mandate to pass on her legacy of leadership.
Well, the book is appropriately titled Pass It On, and the Mary Kay Museum Director Emeritus, Jennifer Cook, is celebrating the international legacy of her friend, mentor, and boss. Mary Kay Cosmetics and Mary Kay, they have had legs, shall we say. The legacy continues. What do you attribute that to?
I attribute it to Mary Kay's philosophies. She founded this company on the Golden Rule and on the philosophy that women should keep their priorities in the order of God first, family second, and career third. And that resonates with so many women. And when they join the Mary Kay sales force, they are independent contractors, and they can build their business on these principles. And so many of them appreciate the freedom to do so.
Well, tell us about the museum. People may not even be aware of it.
Well, the museum is in the corporate headquarters at Mary Kay and Addison. And Mary Kay always wanted to have a museum, and it especially became more dominant in her thinking after she had visited Liberace's museum in Las Vegas. And she even met Liberace. She was a big fan of piano music. And in his museum, he had the gifts that people had given to him. He had his costumes. And Mary Kay was just enthralled with it and so she came back and she talked with it about it so much that for the company's 30th anniversary, the executives decided to give her this gift of a museum in her honor.
Can you go in free of charge? How can you?
Oh, yes, it's free. It's in the corporate headquarters on the first floor, and you can just walk into the Mary Kay building and view the museum. And it has her evening gowns and the evolutions of the products. It's the history of Mary Kay.
Do you use the products?
I have used the products for 50 years, and I can't imagine what I would do without the products.
Well, the color pink, as a listener notes, is not only associated with Mary Kay, but also the fight against breast cancer, and that was something near and dear to Mary Kay Ashe's heart. Tell us about that association.
Well, the very first Mary Kay sales director who contracted breast cancer was back in the 1970s. And back then, there was no research being done into women's cancers. And so when a woman got that diagnosis, she was actually just getting, you know, a diagnosis of death. And when she passed away, Mary Kay was heartbroken, and she thought, you know, we need to do something about this. And she realized that only through research and education could the war on cancer be fought. And so she became very active in educating people about breast cancer, about having their mammograms. We even, at the annual seminar, she would have people come in and give mammograms to the sales force members who signed up because she felt so strongly about that. And she also raised money for cancer research. She raised so much money that finally the executive said, Mary Kay, we're raising so much money for cancer research. Let's start a foundation in your name, and then we can, you know, be even more selective in who mm-hmm. we give these cancer grants to.
The book is Pass It On, What I Learned from Mary Kay Ashe from Jennifer Bickle Cook. And another listener wants to know the significance. This is Linda on Oak Hills asking the significance of the bumblebee. What's the bumblebee about?
Mary Kay was single when she founded the company. And 3 years later, she married her husband, Mel, on a Thursday. Well, the very next Thursday, Mel brought her a present. And Mary Kay, being the smart woman that she was, she looked at him and said, Mel, are you going to bring me a present every Thursday? Well, I just thought that was brilliant, you know, because of course, what could he say? So every Thursday, he presented her with a Thursday present. And we all just loved Thursdays because we were going to find out what Mel was going to give Mary Kay. But one time he presented her with a diamond bumblebee because she used in her speeches the analogy that the bumblebee is wings are too light and body too heavy for it to fly, but the bumblebee doesn't know it, and so he just flies anyway. And she said, that's like women. You know, they come into this company, and they don't know that they can soar to the top, but they, like the bumblebee, they soar anyway. So when she saw it, she told Mel, she said, you know, everyone's going to want one of these. And they did, and we made it a top prize, and it's very coveted in our company.
Well, congratulations on your long association and for the book, Pass It On, What I Learned from Mary Kay Ashe. Jennifer, it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Keep going.
All right.
And Chris Rosado's on deck. But before we get there, we had Dan Moldea, the great reporter on Monday, the journalist who calls Washington, D.C. home. And he talked about how he feels that he is close to solving the riddle of the disappearance of one James Riddle Hoffa, the former leader of the Teamsters, who disappeared in 1975, has never been found. Much speculation, books, movies, you name it, have been produced about where Jimmy Hoffa's remains are. And today in the New York Times, they picked up on Dan Moldea's statements on our show Monday, a photo of Dan, who is about 6'5", a huge man, and a giant in many ways, and certainly journalistically a giant. He's the reporter who changed the trajectory of the careers of Bob Livingston, David Vitter, and Newt Gingrich with his findings about their personal lives. And Jimmy Hoffa is something that Dan Moldea, the disappearance of him, has been reporting on since 1975 when Dan was all of 25 years old. A new FBI inquiry into Hoffa's disappearance is centered on a site in New Jersey, and Dan is pictured there claiming that Jimmy Hoffa may very well be buried in a steel drum right off an interstate in Jersey. And the story from Michael Wilson starts this way. The disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa, a mystery that has gripped the American imagination for half a century on its ascent to national folklore, is the subject of a new FBI investigation centered on the site of a former landfill in Jersey City. A worker on his deathbed said he buried the body underground in a steel drum. FBI agents, armed with a search warrant, arrived in Jersey City at a plot of dirt and gravel the size of a Little League diamond below the Pulaski Skyway on October 25 and 26 to conduct a site survey, according to the Detroit Field Office, which has led the investigation into Hoffa's disappearance in 1975. The steel drum is said to be buried about 15 feet below ground in the shadow of countless millions of drivers who have passed it by. FBI personnel from the Newark and Detroit field offices completed the survey. The data is currently being analyzed, according to a special agent, Mara Schneider. The formal statement did not mention Hoffa by name and did not elaborate on a timeline for any potential excavation. The new investigation, to be sure, has a familiar ring. It follows several failed searches for Hoffa's body over the years in Michigan, where Jimmy Hoffa was last seen outside the Red Fox restaurant. Officers with backhoes have searched various locations, including a farm, a driveway, a swimming pool. In New Jersey, a popular urban legend had Hoffa's remains buried under the old Giant Stadium in the Meadowlands. The 2019 film The Irishman raised another version of what may have happened, portraying Hoffa's character and shot by his friend Frank Sheeran and his body incinerated, but that theory has long been discounted by Hoffa scholars. And Dan Moldea is on the scene, and the new lead is bolstered by records that the FBI received tips as far back as 1975, immediately following the disappearance, that Hoffa was buried in the landfill in Jersey City. Agents searched, and finding nothing, wrote off the tips, and they have no idea where to start looking. They didn't then, but they do now. And it's because of this reporter, Dan Moldea, who got this deathbed acknowledgement, and we'll see if it's true. But if it is true, Moldea will have uncovered one of the results of a mystery that has been around for 46 years. So we shall see what happens. But Dan talked about it here, and lo and behold, on page A19 of the New York Times, it's presented in all its glory today. And it's nice to see Mr. Moldea get acknowledgement for his long work. Moldea wrote about the disclosure, and it has resulted in a full-fledged investigation and the resources necessary to conduct it. We'll be back with Chris Rosada of WAFB Channel 9 after this brief timeout on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We finished the week with young up-and-coming reporter Chris Rosada from WAFB. He's a Capitol correspondent, native of Mandeville, and graduate of Southeastern Louisiana University, where they have an outstanding journalism program, by the way. And he was hired even before he graduated. He just made 25 years old, and remember the name. He's been the Capitol correspondent for WAFB for now how long?
Just wrapped up my first year.
1 year. Yes, in fact, sir. This is like the anniversary, isn't it? Pretty close to it, isn't it?
Pretty close. A couple days ago marked it.
And I mentioned that you grew up in Mandeville, but you were sent off to a military academy in Georgia for a while. How many years there?
Yeah, I was sent there my sophomore year. Finished it out.
So were you a bad kid? Were they trying to reform your career?
No. That's the rap that military schools tend to get is a reform school for troubled youth. But no, this wasn't necessarily the case. Just some issues with grades, but it was definitely something that I was fortunate to be able to be a part of and experience. I'd do it again in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I find that kids who go to military schools often are big achievers, and one of them, of course, was a former president, Donald John Trump, who went to the New York Military Academy, which is now owned by the Chinese, by the way. They bought the New York Military Academy.
Is that so?
Yeah, I went to a high school, a Catholic high school. We had ROTC. I actually carried an M16 around with me. Did you carry a gun?
We did. Obviously, none of them were loaded. Can't remember the type of firearm it was, but it wasn't an M16. It was just a single bolt action rifle, but Yeah, we carried those around quite often.
And then you go to SLU, and as I mentioned, Rick Satoon, he's the guy there. They have a remarkable television program there. And it was so good, and you were so impressive that I guess Rob Hayes probably saw your tape and said, this guy's got what it takes. But was SLU a good background for you?
Oh, absolutely. Very, very fortunate to be able to find the calling to go into journalism and be at that school. The opportunities that come with that program, I don't think you can get at any other university, at least in Louisiana, as far as being able to put together stories off campus and things like that.
Well, that would be heresy for people at the Manship School, but the Manship School may very well, and I hate to say this as a graduate, may very well take a back seat to SLU when it comes to television. And of course, now a lot of kids, they want to gravitate to television. They want to be a star. What was your motivation?
Yeah, you hear that a lot. People just want to be on TV and everything. But, for folks that are just looking to simply be a pretty face on TV, it's not all cut out to be that way. No, you really want to get out there and be able to get the facts to people. That's really what it's about, is being the person to deliver the information to the average person. And that's really where the job comes in.
Well, I can tell you're curious about things, and you not only cover the Capitol, you and your photographer, Rick, you took a lick, and he got hurt worse than you, but you were banged up during Hurricane Ida, weren't you?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We were covering a follow-up story to a man that was out there that we interviewed the day after the storm, who lost just about everything. But, it was a great follow-up story, and we were on our way back from the Terrebonne Parish area, and unfortunately, we were hit in a head-on collision. There was, down there, it's just so chaotic. The traffic lights weren't working and everything, and people were just kind of going at their own pace. And this just happened. I can't even really explain it. It happened so fast. 2-lane highway going about 45, 50 miles an hour. Guy that came into my lane got hit. The tail of his truck clipped and swerved into my lane, hit me head-on.
You were driving?
I was. Yep. Yeah.
And today, reporters are not like reporters of the old days who'd sit in the back seat and kind of take a nap or do whatever. But today, you not only report the story, you usually shoot it, you write it, you edit it. You do the whole shebang, don't you?
Shoot it, you write it, you edit. You're a one-man band a good bit of the time. Fortunately for us at WAFB, we have a great team of videographers that most of the time we're able to be paired with them, depending on what it is that we're covering that day. But for the most part, we get partnered with them, and they help us carry a good bit of that load. But, yep, sometimes you do find yourself
doing it
one-man band. Yep.
Yeah, and you have to know those things, too. Mm-hmm. You can't just be a one-trick pony. You got to do everything, and Chris is doing it, and I'm sure he'll take those skills with him wherever he goes. Sometimes, as we find with Greg Merriweather, who's sat in the chair where you are now, he's been at WAFB for 20 years, but a lot of reporters move on. Matt Houston, before, very talented young man, he's gone. What would compel you to stay? Or are you looking at a quote bigger market?
That's a little too early to tell, to be honest with you. I'm in a 3-year contract, and I just wrapped up my first year, so I'm still learning a lot, and I'm getting more and more comfortable each and every day, making more and more connections with people, building those relationships, and learning more about the state that I've grown up in, and I really love it here. I don't think it would take too much to compel me to stay, to be quite honest with you.
Well, you covered the Capitol, and you've gotten immersed in the characters in Louisiana. Even today, not as many characters as there used to be, but there's some big personalities at the house that Huey built. But next year, we're going to be talking a lot about redistricting. How do you think that discussion will go?
It's going to be a big one. It happens once every 10 years, and it's a big deal. A lot of people, who aren't necessarily politically engaged don't really know a whole lot about redistricting and how important it is. But, I mean, depending on the outcome of, what they agree on to be the map is going to dictate a number of things, especially who wins their reelections. Mm-hmm.
Well, last night on the U.S. House floor, Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, devoted 8 hours, a little more than eight, I think, denouncing the new stimulus bill, the $1.7 trillion measure that follows the $1.2 trillion infrastructure package that just was signed into law. And I can tell from my conversations with you that you're a deficit hawk. I'm thinking you were born in 96, but in 1981, when Jimmy Carter left office, the U.S. debt was under $100 billion. And I checked it today, and it's right at $28
trillion. Wow.
$28 trillion may even be inching toward $29 trillion. It'll soon be at $30 trillion. And even though the deficit went down a bit in Biden's first year, we're in red ink that is in the danger zone. This is an issue most reporters don't follow, even on the national level. Quite often, journalists are not good with math, but those are big numbers. What do you think?
Well, I can definitely agree with what you said about most journalists not being very good with math. It's part of the reason I got into journalism in the first place. No, it's definitely something that everybody needs to pay attention to. You know, that the last couple of presidents that we've had, it's been a continuing trend to just add to the deficit. And
every president has added to the debt except Clinton, and even he in the early years did because he inherited a big deficit. But
correct,
the trend lines are such that since Carter, Reagan and Bush brought it up, Clinton brought it down, Bush too brought it up. Now the deficit actually went down a little bit under Obama. The debt was swelling. In fact, the debt went from $12 trillion to $20 trillion, but under Trump from 20 to 28, and now with Biden, it's going to go into past 30. So why aren't the people revved up about this? It's pretty much a yawner. In fact, I got an email from Lindsay McDougal the other day saying that deficits really don't matter, that we shouldn't pay that much attention, that we've got to stimulate the economy, do whatever we can to make the trains roll, and that we shouldn't necessarily be watching the beans in these times.
Well, I think because just about every president, it adds to the deficit, I think people have kind of gotten numb to that, gotten used to the idea. You know, the old phrase, money grows on trees. I think for some people, they think the United States will never run out of money. And, they don't see it as a big deal that we just keep racking up our deficit. But it'll eventually come back to bite us. And I think we're already starting to feel the effects of that by a lot.
Right. And by the way, I'm looking at the number, and you can go to National Debt Clock, and you can see it. It's $28,974,000,000,000. So It's gone up about $1 trillion under Biden in 10 months. It went under Trump in 4 years, went up $8 trillion. And under Obama, it went up $8 trillion in 8 years. So the trend lines are not really good. David in Atlanta, you get in under the wire with Chris Rosato, Capital Correspondent, WAFB. Hi, David. Good morning,
Mr. Rosato. I'm glad you survived the accident well. And it was Andrew Carr, George W. Bush's first chief of staff when Bush took office. His former job was working for General Motors opposing airbag mandates in all automobiles, just like the Republicans are opposing the vaccine. So Republicans just love to kill people. And, you know,
Come on, David.
Well, I mean,
don't be so cruel on a Friday, a beautiful day in paradise. But you are right about regulation. Some people just don't like regulation, even when it saves lives. Have you been vaccinated, Chris?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's part of the job.
Is it required there?
It is required, but I would have gotten it anyway. I have a sister that works in healthcare. She works in the infectious diseases department, and so having her being able to give her insight on everything, I trust everything that she says.
I'm not sure all the lawmakers at the Capitol have been.
No, I would argue that some haven't. Yep, I think there's a fair bit.
And the vaccine is not perfect, but it's better than not being vaccinated. And I've gotten my booster shot now, and now it's available to just about everybody, I think. So you're going to get round two as well?
No, I don't know about a booster anytime soon. I think, until we see it come down the line where that's going to be required as well. I think we'll hold off until then. Cause I think I'm pretty good for the most part right now. I feel pretty good. Feel healthy.
All right. Well, good luck. Keep going. Good to work with you. Chris Rosato, Capital Correspondent, WAFB. Until Monday for Alondra Villarreal, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.